Welcome to Pardon My Enthusiasm, a horror podcast. Film, spooks, controversy, death, and crime, where the eerie is discussed. I'm your host, Damaris Montúfar.
I am super excited to be doing this. I'm a huge podcast fan, intaking them whenever, wherever, regardless of what I should be doing. And as someone who really likes true crime, history, research, and talking, it only made sense that I'd give it a go at some point and try my own podcast. I super appreciate you giving me the time, and let's see how this goes. The following content discusses suicide. Please visit www.suicide.org for more information and tools on prevention. Today's episode, Chubbuck, a pioneer? In keeping with Channel 40's policy of bringing you the latest in blood and guts and in living color, you are going to see another first, attempted suicide. That was the closing monologue Christine gave to her show, The Suncoast Digest, before she shot herself. She had written down that she was on her way to Sarasota Memorial Hospital and that she was in critical condition, which is exactly what happened. Born August 24th, 1944 in Hudson, Ohio, Christian Chubbuck had a seemingly normal childhood. There's cracks that float around that Christine had a dateless wonder club for all the girls that didn't have dates on Saturday nights. Her mother gave an interview shortly after her death, I think it was about 2 months later, where she disclosed that information, along with the fact that Christine had had one of her ovaries removed. This suddenly created a timeline that she wasn't prepared for. Without a steady companion, she wasn't sure she'd be able to have children. At about 9:30 a.m., July 15th, 1974, Christine Chubbuck was ready to give her show. Armed with a .38 caliber Smith & Wesson, a hiccup occurred with the videotape they were going to show. It was of a local shooting, and the failure of it really changes the way this sets. The shooting was going to be her introduction, her opening into the whole blood and guts TV that she mentioned, and then was to follow her death. When the tape failed to play and they told her, "Hey, Christine, it's not going to play," apparently a very specific look came about her face. Some described it as a bit of a smirk, a smile. I'm picturing something very specific in my mind where the shock of it all makes you grin, like laughing at a very inappropriate moment. What I think makes it most interesting is that she was researching death and suicide and killing, something of that nature. I don't really know what the specifics of the piece she was creating was on, but she wanted her career to grow in the way she was seeing others' career grow. Her closest friend at the station was Andrea Kirby, who read sports. The other person of interest was George Peter Ryan, who read the stock reports. Christine had shown interest in George and had even told Andrea about it, telling her how she intended to proposition him. But the feeling was not mutual. In reality, George and Andrea were seeing each other. She had also just been hired by a Baltimore TV station and was leaving. Christine had to find a way to make her reporting come across as more relevant to the owner and the manager of the station. It's pretty safe to assume she pitched very heartfelt and soft ideas, considering she focused on local happenings like, you know, strawberry patches and this farmer XYZ. But what they wanted was heat. They wanted sensation. And that was not her style. But her style had to wait if she was going to have success. So she went to police stations and asked them how someone would kill themselves. They gave her the type of gun they would use, where they would hold the gun and shoot, and why. And, well, she used those tips. Right before her big newscast, some of her segments had been cut because there was bigger things happening, local fires, local murders, and whatever, and she was furious. This fury is even more understood when you see how people talked about her after her death. The week prior, one of her segments had been canceled in favor for something gorier, and this was a consistent pattern for Christine. So she reacted angrily. They referred to her reactions as tantrums, which just keeps showing just how little they respected her. Her mother even made somewhat degrading comments, and I feel bad mom-shaming, but she pointed out how many dates she had had in the past decade, and how she was a spinster who feared not having kids within the next 3 years because of her fertility problems. It's definitely not to say that these points aren't relevant in what was going on in her mind at the time, but that's all they fixated on, that she was a child who didn't know how to compartmentalize her feelings, and that she was a spinster who was never going to have children. Christine's greatest champion is definitely her younger brother Greg, who gave an interview in 2007 on Entertainment News on their Boulevard of Broken Dreams, and he spoke about how much she detested media obsession with violence and violent visuals. That's why she referred to it as the Glut and Butts Blood and Guts TV you later hear in her suicide speech. At the time of her death, Christine lived with her mother and her older brother Timothy, although Greg lived with them on and off as well. Christine's actions July 15, 1974 really changed things in media, even though people seem to forget who she is. A film that is often attributed as being inspired by Christine Chubbuck's death is Network, a 1976 film written by Patty Chayefsky and directed by Sidney Lumet. The film follows Howard Beale, played by Peter Finch, who is forced to retire after 25 years as a news anchor, and he has this huge outburst on live TV about killing himself the following Tuesday, which is meant to be his last show. Ratings go up like crazy because of this outburst. Because you know as well as I, if I hear something crazy happen on television, I will be Googling the heck out of it. Not quite the same in the 70s, but you get the picture. After that outburst, they had told him he was done. That was it, no more. But because of how well the ratings did for that episode specifically, they gave him another go the next day to do a proper goodbye and an apology to the public. So he goes. He apologizes for his suicide crack, and proceeds to enter yet another outburst. I'm mad as hell, and I'm not gonna take it anymore. This outburst dubs him Angry Man, and so the ratings continue to go up. Diana Christensen, played by Faye Dunaway, the network's head of programming, urges investment in Beale. But like most spectacles, Beale's rants begin to lose their charm and become financially devastating for the company. The company had invested a lot in his new show, literally new stage, big lights, live studio audience, so they had a lot riding on his success. Christensen and other executives weigh their options and outcomes from firing him and decide instead to reap the benefits of him while getting rid of him by, logically, hiring an assassin to murder him on live TV with a studio audience. The film concludes with his murder scene being played in like four different news station reporting thingies. You know what I'm talking about, like it's like little squares and they're all by side by side. Think like a very, very fancy person with a big, big TV that's got a bunch of little ones, like in Back to the Future. Anyway, some of them are showing commercials, literally like kids eating a popsicle, going for a run, whatever, as other ones are reporting on his death, and not just reporting on it, but repeatedly showing the recording of him being gunned down by a couple people in the audience. The closing is Beale on the ground bleeding, while the voiceover says, "The story of Howard Beale, the first known instance of a man who was killed because he had lousy ratings." And yeah, he could no longer offer his network what they wanted from him, so they took him out. The film as a whole is quite the nice piece. There's a couple dry moments for me, but I don't always have the best attention span. Overall, they were absolutely excellent moments that captured the relevance of ethical loss seen in media in the name of ratings and success. A specific scene that I think of is the New World Money scene, where he just starts yelling about how countries and forms of government do not run the world or societies. It's not about those trade agreements or peace treaties of sorts. It's all about currency. Now, not only did this movie come out 2 years after Christine's death, but you can see the similarities of this live death, which always begs the question of, is this art imitating life? Whether or not Chayefsky had the idea before or after Chubbuck's death is disputed, but I don't see why he couldn't have had an idea that was then inspired by actual occurrences. Films weren't churned out back to back the same way they are now in the 70s, so it's very believable that the idea was there before, but regardless, it's a strong film. The film and the real-life occurrence parallel in not just literally the content of having a gun in someone's life on television, but just the struggle. They were both going through a very difficult struggle, and very publicly. It would have been about 2015 when I first heard that there would be not one, but two films about Christine Chubbuck coming out the following year. The first, Christine, which starred Rebecca Hall, and it's like a biopic where they just make things more dramatic and flirty for the public. And the second was Kate Plays Christine, where Caitlin Scheel plays herself as she prepares for the role of Christine. In my mind, I kind of created a world where Kate is preparing for Christine and does not complete the role of Christine, and thus that fictional film in Kate Plays Christine becomes Christine with Rebecca Hall. Kate Plays Christine opens up with an excerpt from Chubbuck's diary at around age 15. It offers a look into her expectations and desires from adulthood, which included being a seasoned wife, very hostly and all that. This part is echoed throughout the film, not just in content, but they literally repeat these lines like 3, maybe 5 times throughout the whole film, and it plagues it in a very specific way. The film really tries to push like an almost feminist standpoint, but having this background that keeps reminding you that she isn't what she wanted to be as a child really doesn't resonate that. They bring up Network at one point, and the big point they're making is that it was written by males that rewrote her pain as angry man and men controlling her story, but again, they're flitter-flattering with, oh, Christine was not the seasoned wife, and it's one of those like, are you protecting her from this spinster narrative, or are you projecting it? The film has some pretty good moments, specifically the first sight of Christine in full character. It's a very wow moment, a very powerful image, because Kate is very pale and she is light, and Christine has darker hair. She's got a tan, you know, she's a Florida beach babe kind of a vibe, and it's maybe a little spooky to see that translation between the two. This similar sensation is seen in the when they're preparing to shoot the suicide scene. She is kind of in costume. They're still working on her. She's got a wig cap, but not the wig, and she's playing with the gun. She's kind of maneuvering it. She's asking questions, and it's a very powerful image because it's so calm. It's just, you know, just happening, and it's kind of creepy because what is just casually happening, like creepily and dangerously happened in the real event. The film also has segments with interviews, and a lot of the criticisms towards Christine Chubbuck are kind of harsh. I couldn't tell you exactly what they all were. I saw the movie about 3 weeks ago from the point that I'm recording. I did not write down as many notes as I probably should have, but I just remember feeling very like, well, that was unnecessary. It was a lot of pushback on the same spinster cycle, which is again why I felt their whole feminist vibe was really lost in translation. I think of those as more nuisances than anything. My real beef with the film was that there was a little difference between Kate and Christine, which totally could have been on purpose. I might be missing the point that, like, she's just a normal girl. It's an everyday person problem, you know, women be women or whatever. But what it really translated to was neglectful acting. When Kate was being Christine, it wasn't the way she was described, the mannerisms or language from the interviews given by her family and by the limited recordings of her. it just felt kind of lazy. It was the same kind of effort you found from Kristen Stewart in Twilight, which in that case, I'm not going to get into that, but regardless, it just felt dry. The script as a whole also looks like it literally just came out of Sally Quinn's 1974 piece. When I first saw the film, I was like, wow, they know a lot of information I've never heard about. Holy shit, bro, I'm gonna Google it. So I did. That's when I found the Sally Quinn piece. And it's literally like they were like, who needs a script? We have this piece from 1974, the real juice, the real deal. And well, yeah. I'm not going to say I didn't like the film because I still enjoyed it, and I like the idea of seeing someone get into their method acting and, you know, whatever and all that. It's interesting, but I definitely do think it didn't vibrate how it should have. I don't know if vibrate's really the word I'm looking for, but it didn't produce the reaction I wanted from the film. It ended with Kate saying she wasn't sure if she could do the suicide scene, and she didn't. I'm not 100% sure how I feel about it. I kind of love it and I kind of hate it. I love it because it's so sincere. I don't know how I would feel doing that. And in reading about the film, the intention was to shoot it, but Kate did not feel comfortable. And they were like, bro, you know what? Put that in the film because it's so sincere. It's so real to what it would feel like to be doing that. You know, it's kind of weird, the idea of putting yourself in someone else's shoes, putting yourself in that mental state, and then going through with it. I definitely understand and respect that choice. It was just interesting as part of the film because, again, the film already felt like it was kind of trying but kind of failing, and it almost kind of made like a full circle of they tried, but did they really try? Then we make our way to Christine 2016, which starred Rebecca Hall. Let me tell you about how I watched this bitch twice and forgot. I probably saw it about 2 years after it came out, so 2018, and I forgot, which is definitely something I do, but it usually means there was some element about the film that I super didn't vibe with, and so I forgot about it. But in preparation for this, I checked it out from my local library. Support your libraries. And in rewatching it, I was like, bro, I totally know what's coming up. Like, I just like know what's happening. And I credited that to watching way too many commercials about the film and just all my research on Christine. But bro, like, there's not that much information, and the things I was remembering and thinking of were way too accurate. Like, it's all the fabricated things, the things that made the story more interesting, which means that I did not remember them. I had just seen it, and I went onto my IMDb. Lo and behold, there she be. I had seen it. All the same, we all do it. It's not like it's a bad thing that I rewatched it, especially since it wasn't very fresh in my mind. But Rebecca Hall captured what Chubbuck is described as by her friends and family and the limited tapings absolutely perfectly. I was quite mesmerized by her performance, and I do think it affected the way I saw Kate place Christine, because I was like, bro, this right here, this is Christine. For me, it was like a really crystal clear portrayal, like right there, right down to the face, like the way they did her makeup and dressed her, she looked just like her. While in Kate Plays Christine, while I did mention being like, whoa, what a transformation, that was because of the comparison of what Kate looked like, not because they actually did that good of a job making Kate look like Christine. The film changed certain things that are known as fact about Christine, which is super anticipated to make things a little more interesting, but it didn't really diminish from the root of the story. It focused on her feminine issues of the fertility, virginity, companionship, yada yada, but it also really touched on her struggles with depression, which was nice. I felt they talked about it very well, and while they didn't quite juggle it perfectly, the feminine issues and just general depression, they tried, I guess. I don't know, it was good enough, I suppose. My major beef was the lack of inclusion of George and Timothy, her brothers, who lived with her and her mom on and off during all this time. I mean,
George gave interviews about speaking with her like the day before, so to have him completely not be a part of it was a little like, well, all right.
Jean Reed was also shown to be Christine's closest friend at the station instead of Andrea Kirby, which, well, all right.
But the big difference between the films and what this film presented that's just new to the entire story of Christine Chabik is a reenactment of her suicide. And while this isn't necessarily the only reenactment of her suicide, there is one on archive.org. Great source, literally great stuff. Check it out. All the same, this one's good. It's full color. It's there. It's not pretending to be a lost film. I mean, like the one on archive, it's like real tape found, blah, blah, blah. So it's all icky and weird and what be it. Well, this is as it would be, or as much as it would be, could be kind of a deal. I'll finish up talking about the film Christine with just, it was good. It was interesting. It played very well. That last scene was very strong. Where she committed suicide, and I definitely would recommend it, but the whole reenactment of her suicide and the fake, quote, leaked videos brings us up to the most infamous of legends regarding Christine Chabik. Does her suicide tape exist? The answer is yes, but kind of no. A tape exists. Christine asked for that day's show to be taped, so it was created, and it kind of makes sense in a warped way that she wanted that. Bob Nelson was the owner of the Channel 40 News, and so the big question was, who had it? Did Bob have it? Did the FBI have it? Did the police have it? Or did Chubbuck's mom have it? And Molly Nelson, Bob's now widow, said that her husband kept the tape vaulted, but upon his death, she gave it to a very powerful law firm. This was confirmed a little after the films came out. Now I want to say no, because it's an old tape and it's been sitting there. It hasn't been digitalized, which means it's probably horribly degraded and will continue to be, which is an argument for people. They're like, give it, we need to fix it. This is a historical event, but not all of history needs to be visualized that way. We don't have to have that moment. I don't think her family wants to have that moment. So yes, it existed, but no, it's not gonna exist for that much longer. I titled this episode, Chubbuck, a Pioneer, with a bit of a question mark, because is she a pioneer when it's something bad? I would say yes. But I know others would not. When I talked about the name of my title, I got the, but a pioneer creates something big, you know, something good, the pioneer of whatever. And yes, I feel that, picking it up, putting it down. But she still kind of snowballed and started. I suppose she isn't a pioneer because she's not credited, but not all pioneers are. While reading about Christine Chabik, I started reading a lot of papers on unnatural deaths, and unnatural deaths were described as those that are socialized through social media, as well as accidents, suicides, and executions meant to incite fear. I'll have all my sources in the show notes, but John Stratton specifically discussed how broadcasted suicide and death is in the media, specifically in the US, where we already have such a big gun culture, it kind of makes it a little wilder. There's a specific line where he wrote, self-annihilation can be thought of as a moment of the individual's entry into the spectacle. It's kind of an interesting place we're at in society. We're more but less exposed to death. There's a statistic that shows that in the last 50 years in Western Europe and America, most adults between the age of 18 and 40 have never stood at a deathbed or, you know, observed an actual death, but by the age of 18, the average American has seen 40,000 screen deaths. It's all very violent deaths, very unnatural deaths, not just someone coming to their final point, but very sensationalized death in films, tragedies posted on the internet. People are just detached from death, making an unnatural death the only death acceptable for everyday life. I see it happen all the time with people I know. They're like, someone just passed and I can't go to the funeral. I just don't want to see them. Or I couldn't go up to the casket. Or, you know, someone sent me a picture of this dead family member and they're horrified, but they're literally going to turn right over, put something on television, and watch people be slaughtered from all angles. It's a hypocritic nature. I don't know if that's quite the way to put it, but we're just, one's okay and one's not. And I get it. Well, this one doesn't mean anything to me. It's not someone I know. It's not someone I love. But at the same time, I can very confidently say a good chunk of us have seen someone die, actually die on television, whether that's something a little more accidental like The Crow or just it pops up on your timeline. It's a societal fascination with violent death. The not fully alive who are not really dead to the viewer. This brings me to a Pridmore and Walter piece where they looked at 6 instances of suicide that was filmed and seen by the public, as well as 2 instances of group death. The piece itself is like a research study meant to connect mental disorders and social factors as causes of suicide, but the piece was very beneficial for me in how I observed Christine's death. The first was Taekwondo in 1963, which I'm pretty sure I butchered already, but, you know, I tried. He's the iconic Buddhist monk whose image is widely used and seen, and his death was a protest by suicide. So it's kind of different, but it was captured on film, but it wasn't the intent to be famous through film. It was just a specific type of political protest native to his monkhood, you know, to his people. Next was Christine Chubbuck, who we have thoroughly discussed, and the focus was her depression and possible mood issues. They thought she probably had a bipolar disorder, and her big social factor was part of it. They're like, you know, she was very unhappy. Bud Dwyer in 1987, it was a Pennsylvanian senator. And his is actually one I had seen clips of on the internet. No idea where, but somewhere. And he committed suicide during a press conference before his sentencing for bribery. And the factory was deemed to be a, you know, prison. People aren't really into that. But it was going to be financial ruin. His family was already in debt. And if he died after sentencing, that would then further put them in debt because they wouldn't be able to receive his senator money. Next was Daniel Victor Jones, 1998. He was HIV positive, had cancer, and he believed he wasn't being well taken care of by his health maintenance organization. So he had a very angry display on the LA highway and committed suicide by shooting himself with what looked to be a rifle while helicopters filmed for the news. The suicide was due to his anger and want to expose because he had a huge, paper flag thing, whatever, on the ground, just explaining why he was there and how he was mad. Michael Marin in 2012, he consumed cyanide after his verdict was announced for arson, and it was being filmed. It was, I guess, a pretty big court case at the time, and the factor's not necessarily to be captured. I think he shares that with the monk as well. He just wanted to die because he didn't want to be, you know, imprisoned. He didn't want to have to face the consequences, so it wasn't about being displayed, it was just about getting the job done. Jordan Romero is the one I'm a little uncomfy by. That one also happened in 2012, and this one is the hard one, and this is the one that a lot of people have seen because it was so recent and it was so obvious. With Marin, it was just a subtle thing. You just kind of saw him touch his mouth, and then a couple minutes later, he's on the ground and then gets, you know, well, he died, and it was cyanide. But Romero, he was being chased by the police, and after being cornered, he pulled out a pistol and shot himself as Fox News helicopters captured it live. It's supposed to be off by 5 to 10 seconds so they can capture this kind of stuff and keep it from being shown, but well, it slipped through the cracks. The reason was bad outcome. He already had a lot of prior offenses and there was no way he was getting out of this without a hefty hefty set of fines and prison time. The kamikaze pilots, 1944 through 45, flew fatal missions on behalf of their country when Japan felt it was losing, and it's considered an honorable death, with about 2,000 Japanese pilots dying. That one is obviously done for honor and country pride, so that's not associated with mental illness. It's just one of those, like, well, dang. The other one that's very delicate for people is the jumpers of 9/11. Some people find the term very offensive. I personally think it's the perfect neutral term. These were the people who jumped off, or possibly fell off, out of the Twin Towers during the 9/11 attack. Roughly 190 to 220 people fell to their deaths. Some think that the people thought they could survive. They're like, bro, if I just jump, I'll make it. You know, what be it. But it's very unlikely that they actually thought that. The real thoughts on why is that falling was better than burning. And if you read into families whose loved ones were thought of as being jumpers, there's a huge, very iconic picture of a jumper being caught. It's a very moving image, and there was speculation on who that was. Some of the families who spoke were like, look, I wouldn't necessarily say that it's not my family member. There was one person who had asthma, and they believed, you know, they would have preferred to jump to have fresh air than to be dying before they're dead because of their illness. Christine Chubbuck is not the reason these people committed suicide in very public ways, but they all still revert back to the same thing, and it's very interesting to just see where it started and how it's gone. Having possibly been the inspiration of a later Oscar-winning film to biopics, a short story that I didn't really like, so I didn't talk about, and there's just a lot when it comes to suicide on television. The biggest takeaway for me from reading all of these things was just how disconnected we are with death, and how that needs to change, how that can change and is being changed by certain people. You look at The Order of the Good Death, Caitlin Doughty, she's a huge advocate for death positivity. And it's not easy, because it's so deep-rooted, despite the fact that it is such a new thing. I mean, we used to care for our dead. We had a closer relationship with dying, and as we've pushed it away and outsourced it, we're now becoming more fascinated with it in this offhanded fashion. That wraps up the first episode of Pardon My Enthusiasm, a horror podcast. I super appreciate you coming along with me. I'm learning, we're figuring it out, and if you have any suggestions on things I could do to improve, please let me know. I'm just kind of muddling through and hoping for the best. Feel free, and please do, follow me on Instagram at pardonmyenthusiasm.podcast, on Facebook at pardonmyenthusiasm.podcast, and on Twitter at pardonmepod. Bye!